Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. If you follow me for some time, you know I write a lot about the South, and my book, Southern Scribblings, is a collection of many of those essays. It's a great book. You're really going to want it. It tells you why I think the Southern tradition should be preserved and why it should be respected. Get Southern Scribblings at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, wherever books are sold online. You're really going to love it. Is the key to ending our progressive revolution the restoration of self-government? Well, sort of. But I'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back to the program. Very glad to be here. All right. We all know we're in a revolution. We can see it. It's all around us. It's been that way since the 1960s. At least that's what's argued. I would say it's been that way since the 1860s. Everything we're seeing now is a byproduct of the war. And most importantly, a byproduct of the real effect of the war, which was centralization of power in Washington, D.C. Everything that people complain about in American society can be traced back to that particular point. Whether it's the modern economics that we suffer from, or whether it's foreign policy, or whether it's the culture war, all of these things go back to centralization of power in the 1860s, at least the starting of that process. I could even argue go back to the Constitution, of course, but if you just want to look at where things really shift, dramatically shift in how we think about government, how we think about society, how we think about the role of government in society. All of that changes in the 1860s with Lincoln and the Republican Party. More the Republican Party than Lincoln, though of course Lincoln's insistence that he had these presidential war powers certainly plays a role in how we think about executive authority. In fact, people pointed out at the time, Lincoln, you know, you're really going beyond your constituted authority here in so many ways. The Democrats pointed it out. Even people in his own party pointed it out, but Lincoln didn't care. And of course, with that said, as Lincoln begins to move the presidency in a different direction, other presidents picked up on that. In fact, what you see if you go through presidential speeches in the postbellum period from the 1860s on, who becomes the symbol of presidential power? Well, Abraham Lincoln. Who does all of these people, I mean, whether it's Democrats, Republicans, who do they look to for examples? The best example, well, most of the time it's Abraham Lincoln. Every now and then you hear someone talk about Jefferson or Washington, but 9 times out of 10, it's Abraham Lincoln, particularly in the Republican Party. And of course, we have to emphasize that from 1861 until 1913, so you're talking about 50 years. Over that 50-year period, only 8 years saw a non-Republican president. Now, it didn't mean the Democrats didn't have a role in Congress. They did. But the presidency, the way we think about the presidency, was formed in that 50-year period. Then you get Wilson, who was a progressive, just like Teddy Roosevelt, also thought the presidency needed to be a prime minister, legislator in chief. He was perfectly fine with moving that presidency, continuing that direction, to the president being the most important political figure in America. So you get to the 1920s. You got Republicans again. Maybe reined that stuff in just a little bit, but by the time you get to FDR, of course, Herbert Hoover, I would say, and then FDR, I mean, it's gone. The presidency became the most important political position in America. At the same time, Congress begins to take a back seat. Every issue becomes a national issue. Every issue becomes something that people have to worry about for the presidency or for the Congress. It wasn't that way in America. I mean, when you look at this revolution that we've been going through, it's been fostered by the center. When you go back to the 1770s, we had a very different kind of revolution that was fostered by the bottom up. And this piece at Law and Liberty gets into this. In fact, it's wrestling with this issue. We've got this big revolution going on. What do we do about it? How do we confront this revolution? And of course, we're talking about the culture war primarily, but this is bigger than that. It goes into our inflationary policies, the massive spending by the center, our economic policies in the United States, our foreign policy. Foreign policy does affect our domestic policy. Libertarians like Ron Paul have been pointing this out for years. He's exactly right. Heck, the paleoconservatives pointed this out. So did a lot of other people. In fact, the most important political speech ever given in the United States, by far, is Jefferson's first inaugural address. That really is the quintessential American speech when it comes to executive power and the true meaning of American government, the way that the majority of Americans saw it in the founding period. That speech is the most important one, his inaugural address. Farewell address from Washington is great, but Jefferson's is stronger because he hits some things that Washington misses. But regardless, we've got this ongoing revolution, and it's been pushed by the left at the corporate level, at the university level, through our media, through our pop culture. It's been encouraged by government policy, particularly from the center, but that's a whole nother issue. There's been some pretty powerful movements against this DEI stuff, diversity, equity, inclusion, from the government entities, right? You've got the Supreme Court going after it. You've got people in Congress taking a look at it. Maybe even the presidency at one point if Donald Trump's reelected. I don't know. We'll see. Joe Biden certainly isn't interested. Barack Obama, who's running the Biden administration, really wants to push DEI. But you certainly, and at the state level and local level, you see a lot more of it, right? I mean, you've got Florida. You've got all kinds of places going after DEI. But the question is, what do we do about it when it comes to the private sector? How do you thwart this revolution at the private sector? That's the big problem. I mean, what do you do about corporations? What do you do about universities? What do you do about your school systems? What do you do about all that? Well, there is an answer to it. But let me get into this because it's a discussion of, the title is Restoring Self-Government. What is that actually? You know, getting power back to Congress would be important. That is true. Congress has got to want to do that, though. See, the issue is Congress has been more than happy punting its responsibilities to the executive branch because they can run on their record saying, well, I didn't do it. I didn't do this. President did it. I didn't do all this. It was president's fault. It's Joe Biden's fault. It's never their fault. The buck doesn't stop with them. The buck stops with the presidency. This is the centralization of power problem. By the way, if you're listening to this today, for the next week, this is May 2nd, for the next week, I've got my newest class. It's a live class at McClanahan Academy, and it actually gets into this topic. The title is Runner-Up, American Presidential Losers. And I go through all of these people that have lost the presidency and what that says about the American public and American government and these individuals themselves. Great stuff. You're going to have to go out there and get the class. I've got the option to pay for it on installments. There's just a few seats left, and I've capped the number of seats in the class. Though you can also use the coupon code ALSORAN and get the class for a good price as well. I've taken a lot off of it if you want to do a one-time purchase. So get that class. Come join me live. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we talk about this stuff because it's really interesting to me, and I hope it'll be interesting to you. But the point of this piece is to discuss an essay entitled Counter-Revolution, and it's written by Daniel Miller. He is one of the editors at IM1776, which I've talked about on this podcast before. Now, I'm not going to go into... There is a synopsis of Miller's essay, so I think that's sufficient for what we're going to talk about, but... It says, Daniel Miller's sprawling essay, American Counter-Revolution, argues in florid tones that the West and America are currently being devoured by revolution. Miller notes that the distinctions which structured Western thought for millennia are in crisis. What once stood between the public and the private, between men and women, between the profane and the sacred, and between the guilty and the innocent has broken down. This revolution, like all revolutions, promises us something new. But Miller notes earlier in the essay that all political revolutions are the same in their essentials. Miller recalls different observations made by scholars on political revolution to the effect that ideologues signify that, quote, revolution inaugurates a rupture in the continuum of history itself. All the old laws are suspended. Everything is made anew. But not so, Miller observes, because, quote, this messianic delusion is recurrent to the revolutionary phenomenon. In fact, almost nothing in history is more predictable and less singular. And nowhere is revolution more at home than in modernity, the epic of revolution unbound. So here are some statements about revolution. Now, is the American War for Independence a revolution? No. Now, there were certainly people that were more radical than others. But as I talked about yesterday, even Kagan notes that when he was talking about this, there was a lot of conservative reaction to this. The brakes were being put on all kinds of things throughout the states. You did have people that were maybe pushing the envelope in some areas, but the states weren't going to go along with that because the American War for Independence wasn't a revolution. It was a bottom-up insistence on self-determination. You see, self-determination, which you could say is self-government, is by no means revolutionary. Only if you're boxed into this idea that there's the West has been defined by non-self-government more than self-government. I think that that's not necessarily true. But the fact is, what was happening in the 18th century in America was simply an assertion of the things that they already had. They insisted they had as English citizens, or at that point, British citizens. The rights of Englishmen that have been codified through centuries of practice, custom, precedent that were now being denied by the center. And so when you look at the 18th century and you look at what's going on in America, again, very bottom up, this is why you had things like the Committees of Correspondence in the 18th century. Well, why were they doing that? Because there wasn't a tremendous amount of correspondence, communication between these states, these colonies. And so those committees of correspondence had a role in bringing the colonies together. That was important. This shows you almost, conclusively, that everything that's happening here was happening at the local. These people were pushing from the bottom up, not from the top down, as this essay we'll get into at the end. He continues, you might think that if revolution is constantly repeated, then surely we know how to deal with it. Maybe ideological revolution is what Harvey Mansfield said, manliness run amok, a nihilistic revolt against deterministic and reductionist theories that man is chained by nature and or that God is dead. The communist or fascist endeavor to prove that a new world can be built by man and that nothing is determined. This existential rebellion has always been resisted by men and women who articulate that there is a nature, ground and purpose to life. We're in a story that we didn't create, but we must participate in it as free and virtuous persons. Miller's essay spans centuries, swiftly moving through the revolutionary implications of state sovereignty, supplanting Catholic Church authority in early modernity to give us the unified state and its mystical power, then on to the French Revolution, and finally some observations on this dismal American scene. How might we Americans know that we are beset by a revolution as opposed to, say, incompetent federal, state, and local governments run by progressive ideologues and their self-interested benefit? And if we are in a revolution, what should we do about it? So how are we going to know we're there? And then what do we do about it? Miller stresses that the French Revolution, and in particular its period of sheer terror that commenced in 1793, provides the example par excellence of revolution and one that we can look to for a comparison and evaluation of our situation. Now, this is a really interesting point. Go to the French Revolution and figure out what's happening now. Now, I don't think this is necessarily a bad analogy. In fact, in the 1860s, you had some of the opponents of the Lincoln administration, which I said the Republicans, talk about how they were in a revolutionary period and that these people, meaning the Republicans, were as bad as the French Jacobins. They were as bad as the revolutionary French. This is what they were doing. Now, you wouldn't have said that really in the 1770s and 1780s because there hadn't been a French Revolution yet and because the American War for Independence did not have that tone. Now, the Federalists started worrying about this stuff. They started worrying about the mob because they didn't think they could control it. But they'd be more than willing to mob themselves, to form mobs and go after people they didn't like too. Just look at what happened in Pennsylvania during the ratification of the Constitution when they would mob those who were opposed to it and beat them up. There was certainly this threat of violence circulating around America quite a bit. I mean, it depended on both sides. But people like Jefferson didn't fear the masses because he thought they were on his side. People like John Adams did. And it's often said that Jefferson was a leftist and Adams the conservative. Maybe so, in terms of their views of what society could be or should do, but not when it came to power. Jefferson was much more astute about what conservatism meant in America, which was preserving the status quo of the political communities. Now, he could change what he wanted in Virginia, but it never went further than that. Those in Massachusetts were always willing to tinker with everybody else. So the piece continues. If we're looking to the French Revolution, he observes the following. The slide into chaos in France following the execution of Louis XVI in January established the pattern which all subsequent revolutions repeated. In February, conscription was introduced across France, and a royalist revolt began in the Vendée. In April, perceiving conspiracies everywhere, the Committee of Public Safety was established with a mandate to eradicate all opposition. By October, it had liquidated the leadership of the first year of the revolution, and by December, it had moved beyond the guillotine and was organizing mass drownings in the war. Quoting Robespierre from this period, if the basis of popular government in peacetime is virtue, then the basis of popular government during revolution is both virtue and terror. As we say, the revolution devoured its own. Robespierre met his death in 1794, an announced enemy of the revolution he fathered. Miller provides a telling bit from this period, one that we might understand when investigations were eliminated so that citizens could be charged merely by being denounced, and the accused were deprived of their right to an attorney and to cross-examine witnesses. Thousands were executed this way. Cancel culture doesn't send its victims to the guillotine, but it does inflict psychic pain on them and often removes them from employment, friendships, and the good opinion of many people. As we were told during the attempt to destroy the career, character, and nomination of then federal appellate judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court in 2018, believe all women. The public ritual denouncements of those deemed racist, sexist, homophobic, anti-immigrant, etc. occurs frequently, and according to criteria that in many cases cannot be challenged by the accused or their defenders. Too many of us have either watched these attempts and remained silent out of fear, or we have been on the business end of such accusations. That they are now increasingly uttered for nothing more than political gain is also rendering them less and less effective. Maybe. I do think people are waking up to this stuff. They're looking at it and saying, this isn't true. This is wrong to do. When you have Bill Maher pushing back on these things, Jerry Seinfeld, these people aren't conservative. They're saying enough is enough on this stuff. This is stupid. I mean, if you go out and watch the Seinfeld show, it's really politically incorrect in a lot of ways. It's very funny, but you couldn't make that show today. That show is 30 years old. You couldn't do it. But on to the real engine of revolution in America, which Miller states is the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the administrative state as construed by FDR's New Deal, which has steadily accumulated power for almost a century. As revolutions go, this has been a long, slow one. As I said, certainly you can look at the 1960s or even the 1930s. Got to go back before that, though. You got to go to the 1860s, because FDR's New Deal is impossible without Lincoln and the Republicans' regime in the 1860s. The Civil Rights Act certainly is impossible without that regime. And so that's the beginning. It's been a longer and slower march than what the piece says. The Civil Rights Act, CRA, only makes sense in its original colorblind understanding, the public argument that was, in fact, used to justify it and obtain its passage. However, by the end of the 1960s, progressives have morphed the CRA into something else entirely, using race to make discriminatory decisions in employment, public and private, and education, and shaping Americans to be constantly aware of a racist past that demanded affirmative action. Evidence of racial discrimination is not even required under disparate impact theory. Consistent patterns of unequal outcomes among races can be used to indict an institution for violating the Civil Rights Act. So it doesn't even matter if there is any racial discrimination. Just look at outcomes. Well, clearly the outcomes are racist, right? So we can just announce things because this is what's happened based on the Civil Rights Act. I don't think it's incorrect to say the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a real legislative enhancement of what was already happening, without question. And if you're talking about all these issues like, you know, DEI and other things, well, I mean, certainly this is part of it. Reagan administration lawyers and the judges and justices that it appointed attempted in many cases the long rollback of this perversion of the statute and found limited success. But they were undone by more federal civil rights legislation passed during George H.W. Bush's presidency that specifically aimed at rolling back the judicial decisions. So, the Reagan administration tries, the judges there, they try to roll some of the stuff back. It's undone by another quote-unquote conservative who just followed into office, George H.W. Bush. This is why the Republican Party has always been the party that's done these things, right? I mean, look, again, in the first 50 years from 1860 to 1913, 1861 to 1913, only 8 years. Out of those 50, did you have Democrats in the White House? Same man both times, Grover Cleveland. So, I mean, the Republicans own it. Just like they own this stuff, right? The most recent ruling in 2023 by the Supreme Court that held affirmative action programs at Harvard University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to be violations of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment is a substantial move toward this colorblind understanding, one that should also inform how we think about the Civil Rights Act. The charge of revolution is hard to sustain when we learn that conservatives have achieved a long-sustained constitutional and political objective, favored by a majority of the minorities in the same racial groups that benefit most from these types of racial classification schemes. The Supreme Court ruling has been a great thing because it used the 14th Amendment against the 14th Amendment. I mean, the 14th Amendment has perverted everything only because of the interpretation of it. But that's been the vehicle. I mean, that is the new Constitution, without question. The goal must now be to extend this precedent even further into private and public employment rules and permit Americans to be equal under the law. So yes, tremendous mischief and power were created by the perversion of the CRA from its original meaning, but that effort now finds itself equally matched, if not on a course for extinction. Originalist and natural law arguments have slowly been accepted and forced racial double standards, standard advocates, to declare who they are in explicit terms. Most Americans don't like it one bit. When these people who are DEI people have to say who they are, most Americans are turned off by it. They don't want it. This is not to gainsay the current position of diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology that now fills our education system, much of the private and public sectors, and most disturbing of all, the military. Most disturbing of all, the military. The military has always been this way. This is the funny thing about people that have this very, you know, glorious view of what the military is. It's a government institution that forces government propaganda, government training, and government outcomes on young men. It's all it's been. I mean, people called it a welfare program back in the 19th century. I mean, John Randolph called it that. It is a way to use government power to your advantage for young men who would maybe not be inclined to think this way, but you get them to think this way because you beat it into them, literally, as you're going through boot camp and other things. DEI is totalitarian in its implications, but as more and more Americans see it in this full evil light, it now increasingly finds itself on its back foot. Nowhere has it been more concentrated than in universities and colleges, and nowhere does its self-perpetuating hatred stand more fully revealed for all to see. Miller's description of our social and political life isn't entirely wrong, but he fails to do justice to the numerous ways the antibodies of our constitutional system of government and the habits, mores, and outlook that it guides continue to match the left, even in its most dastardly and reality-denying form. 6'3" teenage boys in skirts playing on girls' athletic teams, fathers watching a 16-year-old male slam the ball on their smaller daughters or throw them to the ground are told that it's fine, it's just fine. But if we take the hard edge of progressive attempts to forego the regular admission of criminal justice, advance DEI programs, flout the rule of law when it suits political objectives, and punish political opponents, among other items, we must also consider the aggressive confrontation with these forces by a range of American citizens and elected officials. We got to consider, if these people are doing all this stuff, we got to consider all the other things, the aggressive confrontation of these things, right? He says, those opposed to these progressive ideas occupy tremendous positions in government and increasingly use that power to rebut them. Media and corporations are a different matter entirely, but even here we witness a pulling away from the strident appeals and campaigns that emerged in the horrible summer of 2020, as consumers and legislators continue to record their disagreements. It is a strange kind of revolution when its opponents have popular and lawful means to contest it and do so with success. What those of us opposed to the left's current program don't yet have is the ability to defeat it outright. So we engage in politics for the opportunity to steadily undermine the so-called woke agenda. Defeating DEI will turn on members of various minority groups disaffiliating with identity politics and progressive politics and stating why in various public forums. That process is currently underway and has never looked more promising. Announcing that conservatism or the center-right believes that its counter-revolution calls for elimination of CRA would likely send every wrong signal imaginable to those questioning or on the verge of revoking their long-term membership of the political left. So there's promising things going on. I mean, we're seeing some efforts and they're bearing fruit in some ways. But this is where the piece gets interesting. He says, the administrative state, Miller assists, is another part of the revolution because it's an instrument of the secular salvific process of history that some progressives believe will conclude in egalitarianism, net zero energy, and all-around socialism. These are sweeping objectives that certainly require draconian rules, enacted and enforced by bureaucrats insulated from politics. The more likely scenario of the administrative state is unbounded statism, where presidents use old, broadly worded, and seldom used sections of statutes to support contemporary leftist objectives that Congress balks at approving. This part of our government needs to be halted and remade. Reforming the administrative state occupies no end of thinking in the conservative and libertarian worlds, and to date, limited progress has been achieved. making matters difficult and not emblematic of revolution, is the high political market demand made by voters for regulation, which Congress has acceded to. The disciplining of the administrative state would likely come through new doctrinal victories in the federal courts that limit its powers. This could also be coupled with congressional membership that actually wants to be part of government by writing, debating, and approving legislation with clearly defined rules that don't afford open-ended powers to the bureaucrats. Talk about a counter-revolution. Now, that last part, where Congress is going to do this stuff, don't hold your breath, right? Congress, I think, is pretty much done in terms of an effective part of the government. They don't really care that the president gets all of this heat because it takes it off of them. And they can run around saying, well, you know, we tried to do this and it was blocked. Man, just one of the things Republicans are very good at doing is fundraising off of things they're never going to fix. It's true. But they don't really want to fix. He says, that is to say, the one thing most needed regarding the administrative state is the recovery of politics and the institution of Congress as a deliberative body. Now, this is where I would disagree. Congress being a deliberative body is okay, but what they really need is massive decentralization. We need state powers. We need the states to get out there and get in front of this and just start saying no to the center. Now, they're all addicted to the cash drip, just like everybody else. It's very hard to do that, but they still can. They still have the powers. You see, the dirty little secret in all this, and we talk about secession, decentralization, all this stuff. You're assuming the center has sovereignty, and it doesn't. It has powers. Just as the state has powers, but the states created the center. We have to understand that. The center has powers, but it doesn't have sovereignty. This is why when Southerners left in 61, they're looking around, scratching their head, thinking, well, what the heck's going on here? We did this through self-determination. We had conventions. We had all kinds. We followed the way that we do things. And now you're saying this is all illegal. It's silly. There are many obstacles standing in the way of that recovery, but one that should be surmounted by both the left and right in America is to cease viewing the other as implacable enemies who must be defeated at virtually any price. We either want to be self-governing or we don't. Now, this is a really interesting point. This is kind of a reconciliationist message. The left and the right have to get together and they have to say, you know, we're not enemies. We want self-government. This is my point about decentralization. The Congress isn't going to do this. There's no way the House of Representatives is going to do this. Unless you want Mitt Romney or John McCain, the left won't do it. So basically, the right would have to get in line and say, we're going to go along with the left. We're going to go along with Hakeem Jeffries. And this is what's happened with Speaker Johnson recently. So the real power has to come out of the states. We know the left is willing to do this on certain issues at the state level. The right needs to do the same thing. I don't think there's any hope for the Congress to start reconciliation. That's not going to happen. The states simply have to understand that you're going to have left-wing states, or people of the states. You're going to have left-wing states, you're going to have right-wing states, and that's okay. It's not just about recovering the institution of Congress as a deliberative body. That's why I said this is one issue where I think they're a little short, the author's a little short-sighted. Great, have Congress as a deliberative body, but also understand, we need the states. We need the people of the states. Again, the center is not sovereign. It has powers. There's no sovereignty in a government that can be abolished by something else. The states can't be abolished by anything. No matter what Congress did during Reconstruction, which was highly unconstitutional, the states cannot be abolished by anything. The central government can. The states can abolish the central government if they choose to do so. They've already done it once. They did it in 1788. Created a whole new one. Based on the powers of the old one, but a whole new one. You see. Yet for all of this, Daniel Miller's argument that we are in a revolution and that the proper response necessitates counter-revolution, which he leaves unspecified in content, is surely a bridge too far. Because Miller's counter-revolution is unclear, I can't really offer much of a response to it, he says. It evokes Hannah Arendt on the need to purify public libraries in a matter analogous to that performed by colonial elites in the Declaration of Independence, one of several indications that Miller's counter-revolution will be top-down. And this is what I was talking about earlier, but the Declaration was not as elite-driven as he suggests. As Pauline Meyer beautifully demonstrates in American Scripture, there were many such declarations emerging from numerous communities, entities, and localities in revolutionary America. The urge for a new constitutional freedom was in the fire and the blood of the Americans. We might better think of our declaration as the capstone to a process of spirited conversation and deliberation, reverberating amongst the people who are realizing that while legally separate, they were also forming a unity whose power would be needed to win their liberties. So what he's talking about here, essentially, is we had 13 independent countries who were bubbling up their own declarations. I mean, think about it. Virginia declared its independence before the declaration was written. You could say the same thing about Maryland. These independent entities were bubbling up from the bottom. This was a bottom-up movement, of course, driven by the elites of the colonies. There's no question about that. But not from the Continental Congress. It came from another area. I mean, you can say, well, yeah, but what about John Adams and Richard Henry Lee and all this? These people were already doing this stuff before that. Now, we know that some of the colonies were drag-kicking and screaming into this. They didn't really want to do it, but the other colonies were going to do it, so they went along with it. But again, even in that resistance, it shows you that they still had some authority. The vote for independence was by colony, not by individual, by colony. He says they, meaning the colonies, chose to be self-governing and to invoke the Republican ideas that they've been practicing and refining for over 150 years. Longer. This is where Henry says we have the ancient constitutions. I mean, 150 years, 1776. Yeah, you're going to the 1620s. I mean, longer than that. What? 1619 would be the first elected assembly, so I guess you could say, you know, over 150 years is accurate. But, I mean, you have to go back before that. To go back to 1215, when he says their problem was that the English had again reverted their unwritten constitution to an authoritarian posture, justifying violence against the North American colonists. Their unwritten constitution. Again, American constitutionalism as written documents is unique in that it's supposed to limit powers. So this part is right in that he's looking to legislative powers to stop, to arrest some of these problems. But it's not from the center. It has to come from the states. The real push in America has to be, hey, I've got a slogan for you. Think locally, act locally. Our progressive opponents continue to afford us ample opportunity to vindicate our ideas and convictions against their own. That process is slow, ambiguous, and fraught with disappointment. What we should do is again choose to be self-governing by clearly proclaiming progressive constitutional abuses and how we, as a constitutional people, bound by law and moral judgment, intend to redress it. But that will require us to begin with being conservative about the one thing most needful, constitutionalism and the citizens of virtue who must maintain it. Now, I agree. Constitutionalism as an ism, but what does that even mean? Which constitution? Well, we got Kagan yesterday talking about the left followed the Constitution. They're saying we're being constituted. This is constitutionalism. We've got 14th Amendment originalists on the Supreme Court now. That's the Constitution. What are you talking about? No. It can't just be constitutionalism. It has to be federalism. Because that's the bedrock of the Constitution. If we didn't have federalism, the thing never would have been ratified. That's the whole point. We gotta have federalism. the powers of the states. People have to start thinking from the bottom up. Think locally, act locally. You don't think globally. Ridiculous. Your life is determined most by the community you live in. We all got to, then you can work from there, right? I mean, you can work up to the center. But if the states just started saying, yeah, we're not doing this, if you started cutting the knees out of the feds from the bottom up, a lot of things would change. And of course, we have to start talking about some of the arguments for the Constitution. One of the most important thing when you just get to taxes, because that's the issue that really gets everyone, right? I mean, the central government operates on individuals for taxes. You got to pay your taxes. You can't get around it. But the thing is, if we really started thinking about who should have the most taxing power, it was always argued the states should have the most taxing power, because that's where all of the things that go on in your life take place. I mean, if you want to have this socialist utopia, well, then you should pay high state taxes. And those that want it can live in those states. And those that don't have to be subjected to that. And they don't have to pay it for other people in other states. That's the way it works. You want it, you pay for it. I mean, this is when people cry, they move to leftist states and they want this and that, and then they get their tax bill. And oh, this is so high. Yeah. This is what you asked for. So if you don't want that, don't live in states that do that stuff. He ends by saying, how are we doing on that question, right? How are we doing on the question of constitutionalism and the virtue of the citizens who must maintain it? He says, the choices currently range from a dementia patient, Joe Biden, trying to be POTUS. He's not. And a vitriolic ex-president who wants to defeat the current president while demanding our ultimate loyalty. Is that really our choice? You have a choice not to vote. You have a choice to focus on the states. Again, looking at the center. See, the problem with this piece is you're going right to the center again. You're complaining about a top-down, but then you're saying we need to work at this at a top-down. The problem is we've got this top-down situation, so we need to go more top-down with Congress. We need to go more top-down with constitutionalism. See, this is where these people can't really get around this. He says, basic constitutional work stands before us. Talk of counter-revolution is at best a distraction from this hard course. But again, I mean, people are just looking at the system and saying, this is what we've got. They're going to abuse us. We should abuse them. I caution people on this. We're more than likely to get a left-wing dictator than we are a right-wing dictator. A left-wing fascist than we are anything else. I mean, this is the truth. So why go with the center? It has to come from the bottom up. It's the only way we're going to do it politically. It's great to talk about self-government, and of course the opening title of the piece again is Restoring Self-Government through Congress. No, from the states. That's the issue. All right. Hope you enjoyed this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show. I'll see you next time for the next one. See you then.